This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. My name is Jamil Lakhdar-Hamina. I want to thank the Socialism Conference for allowing Cosmonaut to speak. It's a privilege, it's an honor, so thank you. So with that being said, let's get going. So today we're here to talk about a funny term, scientific socialism. And in this talk, my comrade and I will primarily address two things. So what does this term scientific socialism mean, and why you should be or aspire to be a scientific socialist? So I will be tackling the first point, and my dear comrade Joseph the second. So what does this term scientific socialism mean? In Friedrich Engels' famous work, Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific, he makes a distinction between scientific and utopian socialism. The gist of the book is short, whereas socialist predecessors to Marx and Engels were utopians, Marxists were scientific. Now this seems like quite the power move. After all, to say one is scientific lends oneself putatively a degree of authority. But let us take this stuffy claim seriously and investigate what it means by analyzing this distinction. So the distinction between the two, utopian and scientific, can be summarized in three points. So utopian and scientific socialists differ on their conception of human history and the motive forces behind historical and social change. Let us call the utopian conception, for lack of a better term, idealist. And in contrast, scientific socialists share a materialist conception of history. So second, utopian and scientific socialists differ on their conception of how to struggle for socialism. Let us call the utopian conception truth-talking. In contrast, scientific socialists do not believe truth-talking to be sufficient to win the struggle, and they share a class struggle conception of the fight for socialism. That is, they believe class struggle to be entirely central to winning the fight for socialism. The third point is that utopian and scientific socialists differ on their conception of how socialism will come about and be built. Let us call the utopian conception cookbook socialism. In contrast, scientific socialists scrupulously study existing technical and social conditions in order to best place themselves to help build socialism, keeping in mind, as good materialists, that socialism cannot be forced into being, and that the existing technical and social conditions will shape how socialism will come about and look. So on the first point, idealist versus materialist history, I will not have time to go through entirely the materialist conception of history, the theory of historical materialism. I'm going to keep things incredibly brief. Any research program or theory of history worth the name must in some way be able to look at the detailed and complex career that constitutes human history and come to terms with, at least, the course features of this career, how we got here, and where we are possibly going. In order to retrodict and predict human history, just as the best scientific theories come up with elaborate machinery about unobservable entities to explain the causes behind the rich and varied texture of our observations, so history as a discipline should try to come up with the unobservable kinds, the causes, the direction behind the varied and rich texture of human history, in order to explain for us, as socialists, how and why major social transformations occur, why and how socialism can come about. Marx precisely dedicated much of his intellectual activity to sketching out a program or even a theory of social revolution. I will read the famous preface from A Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. In the social production of their existence, men inevitably enter into definite relations, which are independent of their will, namely the relations of a production appropriate to a given stage in the development of their material forces of production. The totality of these relations of production constitute the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which arises a legal and political superstructure, and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness. The mode of production of material life conditions the general process of social, political, and intellectual life. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their existence, but their social existence that determines their consciousness. At a certain stage of development, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production, or this merely expresses the same thing in legal terms, with the property relations within the framework of which they have operated hitherto. From forms of development of the productive forces, these relations turn into fetters. Then begins an era of social revolution. So, dense passage. Relations of production and productive forces, these are the unobservable things whose dynamics are essential to explaining major social transformations. So I won't go into the specific content of historical materialism, kind of fleshing out that really dense passage, the fettering theory attributed to Marx and Engels and explaining social revolution, the debate of the determination of base by superstructure, but let it suffice to say that the goal of a theory of history and one which looks at the dynamics of unconscious forces, notably class structure, economic structure, superstructure, and ideology, to explain the course of history, the upheavals, the tragedy, and the drama, its direction, and that this goal is really what is key to the project of historical materialism. So this goal, this research program, is the hardcore of a materialist conception of history, of a scientific socialist conception, whatever forms specific theories take. So for an idealist, a utopian in history, what explains major social changes in human history are primarily conscious forces. So that is changes in ideas, in beliefs, and attitudes. Of course, change in ideas and beliefs is a cause of social change, but it's hardly sufficient to explain much of anything. Idealists also tend to believe that history has a secret meaning and direction to history. Not a direction dictated by unconscious forces, but a direction dictated by highfalutin principles like truth and justice, so that history is moving towards and for ideals of, say, truth or justice or beauty. In the words of Marx, ideas never lead beyond the established situation. They only lead beyond the ideas of the established situation. Ideas can accomplish absolutely nothing. To become real, ideas require men who apply a practical force. So let's take an example of a major social change, and I'm going to be like incredibly brief. So the rise of Christianity. So Christianity is in one sense of the term, it's a body of ideas, beliefs, and practices. But how did it come about that it became a world religion and the official religion of the Roman Empire? The answer does not lay in the fact that it embodied justice or truth. How does the truth or justice of anything explain what happens in the world? But that its proto-communistic message appealed to the peasantry and poor of the empire and to those peoples subject to alien Roman rule, so that the struggle for Christianity became entangled with the class struggle against Roman Empire. That is, the secret of the rise and conquest of Christianity does not lie in the ideas of Christianity, but the class structure of Roman society. So now to go on to the second point, truth talking versus class struggle. Now, this idealist conception of history means that in fighting for socialism, all that is required is not struggle, force, but that we need only speak the truth to anyone. We need only explain the justice of the society we fight to anyone, and all people will be one to our side. And so we can all begin the project of building a more democratic and egalitarian society. History changes by leaps and bounds by the introduction of revolutionary, true, and just ideas. People need only hear them, and they will transform by miracle and build the promised land. This conception of change, the truth-talking paradigm of social struggle, is one shared by many utopian socialists. Now, a scientific socialist believes that speaking the truth is, of course, very important and a terrific ideal, except that what is desirable socially for one group is not the same as what is desirable for another. Egalitarianism and democracy appeal to one group, but not to another. And so socialism as an ideology will appeal to those who will most benefit materially and spiritually from it. That group today is constituted by the proletariat, by the peasantry, by the lumpen proletariat, and the most desperate proletarianized elements of the petty bourgeoisie. But the truth of socialism will not appeal to the bourgeoisie, to the frenzied petty bourgeoisie. And though we may attempt to shift them by speaking the truth, our words will fall on deaf ears. So what is to be done? Well, if we are serious about winning the fight for socialism, we must seize power. We must engage in class struggle by writing, by speaking, by building parties for and by us, organizing labor unions and leading strikes, by contesting elections with the goal of organizing our forces and spreading our message, to one day seize state power and suppress the power of capitalists, the bourgeoisie, and their political and cultural lackeys. And we must finally seize state power by force and not by choice or election of our enemies. This is the proletarian and class struggle conception of social struggle. Finally, cookbook socialism versus realistic socialism, for lack of a better term. It sounds stuffy to say realistic, but that's the term I came up with. Now, utopian socialists also tend to share a certain vision of how socialism would come into being. We socialists need only speak the truth, and part of that truth for an idealist or a utopian is the incredibly detailed plan of how society will run. This plan will, for instance, include detailed notes on economic organization. Workers will unite in co-ops or some other such organization, association. Society will be run for administrative affairs by councils. Councils will be run in this and that way. This utopian conception to want to impose the brilliant detailed plan of a thinker on existing conditions can be termed cookbook socialism. The problem is that this cookbook conception of building socialism flies in the face of reality. Socialism cannot be imposed. It comes out of the ashes and structures of capitalism, from the struggle of the proletariat and the peasantry. Capitalism has certain features. Capitalist economies run a certain way. The state functions a certain way. Law functions a certain way. And in order to change all that, we are subjected to a paradoxical position of, to use an image by Neurath, Otto Neurath, of being on an ocean on a boat, rebuilding that boat piece by piece as we try to prevent ourselves from being submerged under the water. We need to know how things run, how things would break down with such and such changes. We need to have a patient and rigorous understanding of how society behaves, how it changes, in order to slowly and patiently change it, help it transform by the efforts of the masses into the sort of society we all want. This is the scientific socialist's realistic conception of building socialism. But there is a paradox here for the realistic conception. We have to change things, but we have to have some sort of idea of how to change things. And we cannot say, as so many socialists do, we will figure it out as we go along. No, we have to have something like a roadmap where there are many different paths to a relatively well-defined destination. And now part of drawing up that roadmap means not only understanding how society functions, but also understanding the complex technology and science on which modern society runs. Scientific socialists are not only interested in the complex machine and animal that is society, but in the hidden secrets of nature, how it works, how it can be probed and interacted with to change and, in fact, ameliorate human life through technology. Nothing short of having this roadmap and knowledge will allow us to help build socialism. And without this roadmap and knowledge, absolutely no worker will take us seriously and trust us committed socialists with leadership. And without leadership by socialists, there will be no socialism. So thank you.
Hi there. I'm going to pick up on the thread there that my comrade about. I think we should begin with the fundamental point of the matter, which is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to struggle for political power. We want to win. Our struggle is against the organized class order of the bourgeoisie in the form of their state, their institutions, and their ideas. To put that in more direct terms, we struggle to win the confidence of the mass of working people, and by winning their confidence, convincing them to join us in that struggle as a class in order to seize state power. In the normal operation of capitalist society, working people are not given opportunities to develop that confidence or their capacities. The typical worker is tied more or less by their circumstances and penury to a state of passivity. Their whole lives are ordered by their bosses. The dull compulsion of economic relations, in large part determines the conditions of their existence, where they live, what they eat, etc. So for the average worker, the world might appear as an assemblage of uncontrollable factors. The typical way that this is expressed in people is either there's an indifference to political affairs, I mean, they don't care, or there's a resignation to the, you know, like to the despair of having no way of influencing what's going on in the world. And, you know, that despair also leads to magical thinking and irrationalism. People start to grasp towards these forms of thinking in order to make sense of the world that they don't understand. So stated simply, capitalist society disorganizes the worker. Instead of revealing the structure of society, it obscures it. Instead of giving them the tools to intervene, it pulverizes them into passivity. And, you know, despite the fact that capitalist society is actively disorganizing the worker, there's disorganizing tendencies, workers still manage to organize, you know, on their own initiative. They form unions, they organize strikes, and other forms of resistance to capitalist interests. So the fact that workers still manage to organize for their own interests, despite the fact that capitalist society is constantly disorganizing them, would suggest that there exists a deep impulse among workers to struggle against their bosses. So you can take more than one approach to answer the question where that impulse comes from. You can say, for example, that workers are uniquely or innately combative in some essential way. Sure, you could say that, but you know, then what's the essence of this? What's this essential nature then? The approach of scientific socialism and historical materialism is to make clear the dynamics that compel workers to fight and protect their interests. And so it's attempting to make their activity intelligible to them in relation to the material basis and structure of society. Within the struggle for socialism, I would like to make two important distinctions. So how do we win political power? And then once we've accomplished that, how do we build social society? So these distinctions are mutually reinforcing. So in order to win people, the working class of socialism, you have to convince them that you know how to build it. So it's rather easy to see why this is the case. Like, just as a funny example, would you trust a surgeon to perform open heart surgery without a sense that they know how to do that? To begin with, I'll start with the first distinction. How do we win socialism? So it's in large part three main factors. It's one, it's making the structure of society understandable to the working class. Two, explaining how their struggle arises from this structure and how that struggle is actually a struggle for political power. And three, convincing the class to unite in organization to take this struggle to its logical conclusion, the conquest of state power by the working class. So for the first factor, I'm sure everyone here has heard that old saying, knowledge is power. So understanding why things happen and why these things are in large part a result of structures in society, it gives workers confidence that they understand the world that they live in. It also allows them conceivably to intervene in the course of political events, and it turns them into active and conscious participants. In fact, you could say that scientific socialism is a pivotal development because it inaugurates a period of human history in which the lower orders have access to the knowledge of society, and so it opens the way for them to change it. This is different from utopian socialism, like my comrade mentioned earlier, because for utopians, the knowledge of society comes from brilliant minds or individuals who by intuition, and then they give it to the workers, kind of Promethean in that sense. But this is not really a framework that's conducive for increasing confidence of the workers. It increases dependency, actually. And what we want, ultimately, socialists want to develop the capacity for working class for self-struggle, self-emancipation. In the second factor, it's not enough to understand the structure of society. It's also necessary to connect the actions of working people with that structure. So it's like I said before, it's pretty apparent that even though everything in capitalist society disorganizes workers, like I said before, workers still organize themselves for their interests despite the fact that capitalist society actively disorganizes them. So the spontaneous actions of workers need to be explained in terms of the reactions they're having to the structure of society. And so by doing that, it makes it clear that their struggle, their actions, aren't just a set of randomly disconnected events, but they express a fundamental question in society, which is which class is in charge. Lastly, to win socialism, we have to convince the working class that to unite in organization to conquer state power. The reason follows from the first two things that I said. Once you have the knowledge of society and, you know, our actions in it, we need to follow the thread to the very end, which is, with this knowledge, how do we change our conditions? The working class is that class of people who have been dispossessed of any means of production. So unlike the capitalists who can command society with their command of money, workers typically don't have lots of money to do that. But what workers do have is they have the sheer number of people on their side. They are the majority of society, after all. They have their talents, they have their skills, and they have their energy. So working people, by becoming conscious of their position in society, in the structure of society, and how their actions are compelled by the structure, gain the understanding that only by uniting as a class, conscious of these things, can they form a force capable of taking state power. So to sum that up, socialists need to be able to make developments in society intelligible to large groups of workers. They need to be able to connect disparate and seemingly isolated events to an overarching class struggle for state power. Thus, socialists need an intimate and rigorous understanding of the underlying material basis, how things are produced, who produces them, by what means and technical methods, and the relationship of these factors to the social structure of society. By doing so, socialists will be fighting to gain the confidence of working people and successfully vie for political leadership. And we need to be seen as people capable of leading society. It's pivotal that our movement develop that scientific and technical knowledge as a means of that leadership without relying on the agents of capitalist rule. So now that we've discussed how to win over the working class to socialism, we now have to discuss the problem of building that kind of society. So historically, Marxists have been really very hesitant to describe in detail the operation of a social society. There's a famous quote from Marx about how he wasn't interested in producing cookbooks for the future. So that hesitancy is still with our movement today. Besides very broad formulations about how socialism will be radically democratic or concerned with planned production of human need, we explain very little about what socialism, how it's actually going to operate. So frankly, this is inadequate. If we hope to win the confidence of workers, like I said before, it's actually necessary to have a pretty good idea of what the roadmap for a social society looks like. I say roadmap as opposed to cookbook. I say roadmap because it's not possible. It's simply not possible to prefigure a completely new kind of society. And attempting to do so would lead us back into the dead end of utopian socialism. We'd be producing a cookbook. So what we need is a roadmap that will identify our general line of march, with the understanding that circumstances will change and will require us to make choices about what to prioritize. The importance of a roadmap is very clearly shown by the experience of actual historical attempts to construct socialism. So I'll just take an example. I'll take the People's Republic of China. We could leave aside the question of whether it's socialism. The fact is that the people involved in constructing, in building the People's Republic of China thought they were building socialism. In 1947, or thereabouts, when the Chinese communists took state power, they did it with the support of workers and peasants, mostly peasants. When they did that, they emphasized the part of the problem that's how do we win people to socialism. They did a very good job in that. The problem actually came when they tried to govern. They found that they hadn't actually developed the other side of the problem, which is like, okay, so how do we build socialism? So the communists didn't have a roadmap. The Chinese communists didn't have a roadmap. And so when they took power, they were at a loss as to how to proceed towards socialism. Under the particular conditions that they found themselves in. And so without this roadmap, this led to frequent vacillations in their policy. So from like 1947 to 1989, the People's Republic of China successfully adopted petty commodity production. Then they went to central planning. And then they finally ended up with a mixed capitalist economy that they have today. So every single time that they kind of shifted their policy, it produces confusion and chaos. And in that confusion and chaos, people undoubtedly, there were a lot of needless death and destruction of productive capacity. So related to that problem is, related to this problem is these layers of people in society. This layer of people of society was specialized in technical skills. So that's like doctors, scientists, engineers, you know, programmers. And this layer of people rely on their access to particular forms of scientific knowledge or technical knowledge, like I said before. These skills are really important for running society, a modern society. Without it, you're going to get more confusion and chaos. The problem with this layer of people, the recurring problem, because it's happened more than once, is that they tend to feel alienated from a project of socialist construction. If they aren't already won over to it by the time we take power, they either all leave en masse or we're forced to integrate politically unreliable specialists into the project. So it becomes necessary then to replace these kind of people, these people with specialized skills, generalize their skills, and generalize it to the point where we can train working class people, we can train the mass of working class people with these skills. That's actually really important, is democratization of like specialist skills and functions. Without that, social society will not be able to function. Due to the fact that modern society is extremely complex and interdependent. The story constantly is that a country like, for example, Cuba or whatever, tries to build socialism, and they find that they don't have the human resources or raw materials to actually produce the things that they would need. So I'm just going to wrap it up. I think the point is, we need to start thinking about problems of socialist construction before the seizure of power. The reason for that being, we need a roadmap to deal with challenges of transition from a capitalist society. The goal of socialism is to transition to a form of society where the economy is directed by conscious decisions about what to produce and how to distribute. And these decisions follow from radical democratic deliberation. The replacement of the social order of one class with another typically involves a period of instability and confusion. And it's precisely in this period that we need the roadmap to guide society. And for that, we will need scientific and technical knowledge, along with the people who have that intimate knowledge of those things, in order to apply the expertise to the problems we know are going to come up. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.